Hi everyone, and good evening, afternoon slash good morning, wherever you are in the world. Thank you so much for tuning in here to the Monday live show, and we've got a really special treat for you tonight, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. But just a couple of things just to make you aware of. Of course, as usual, we are sponsored by my good friends at Quantum Hypno. Check out the link below. And the other thing to say is that this week, we also have another special live show on Wednesday night, and we're going to be discussing the hate crime laws that they've introduced in Scotland. Scotland goes full fascist, and we're going to talk about it on Wednesday night with my good friend, Mr. David Scott. I know you probably know David. He's been on with me before, but we've had some remarkable legal stories coming out of Scotland, and so I want to chat about that. So tune in Wednesday night, 8 o'clock. I'll be here, and so will David, and I hope you'll enjoy that as well. So that's a sort of a little outline for what's happening in the week. Now, I want to introduce our very special guest tonight. He's a San Francisco Bay architect called Richard Gage, AIA, member of the American Institute of Architects, and founder and former CEO of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He now leads the charge for a new World Trade Center investigation, along with his courageous and very helpful wife, Gail, at richardgage911.org. So please welcome Richard Gage into the studio. Hi, Richard.
Hi, David. Good to see you, and
Good to see
thanks
you
for
as well,
having me.
Richard. We were just talking before we came on air about the fact that I wanted to do a 9/11 show, a discussion, a conversation, to help basically provide the critical thinkers who follow me with insight onto that most momentous day in history. And I was saying to you, Richard, I think there's been two big events in the last hundred, well, certainly the last 57, 60, 70 years, 9/11 and COVID. Those are the two major, major events. And back in the days of 9/11, when it happened, I was a normie. I basically believed everything. Yeah, I know. This is my confession. I believed what I was told, and I wasn't alone, and a lot of us did. But you didn't believe everything that you were told back then, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about all the evidence that you found, which I think viewers will find fascinating and instructive. And we're going to have a sort of a talk through that. We're going to talk about World Trade WTC 7, Building 7. We're going to talk about the Twin Towers, and hopefully we'll try and get as much information out to people as is possible. So that's the intent, and we'll do our best to cover it. So, Richard, I know you've got a presentation that you'd like to talk us through, which should hopefully enable viewers and listeners to follow the story as it was. But, as I said, I believed what I was told about 9/11. I did. I know I don't believe anything that I'm told by the authorities. I'm sorry, I don't believe anything anymore.
Yeah, I've
And
lost trust also.
well, see, that's the thing. Trust is gone, and actually, trust in even science. I mean, your background in architecture and whatnot, the sort of hard science now has been so much distorted and twisted in some regards, that it's important that we talk to people like yourself who can hopefully set us straight. So, as I said, 9/11, it's not what they said it was it?
Not at all. In fact, if you hit that button, Jed, we'll just talk about it. I mean, we don't want your audience or anybody to be the last to know. I felt like I was the last to know in 2006 when I came across David Ray Griffin, as you mentioned on the radio, and I was just in shock. My world turned upside down. And so here, we have the opportunity now to use this podcast and this valuable information from collectively 30,000 years of technical experience from 3,600 architects and engineers who signed on to the petition demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three towers. Many don't even know about the first tower, well, the third tower that went down that day. I'm a member of 19 one of 90,000 members of the American Institute of Architects. We didn't get one bulletin on this, the third worst structural failure in modern history. This building was 47 stories tall, easily the tallest building in most of our states, though it appeared dwarfed next to the Twin Towers, because they were the tallest buildings in the world when they were built.
Yeah.
No insignificant building. It's about 100 yards from the North Tower, and it did receive a little bit of damage from the columns that were ejected out of the North Tower, as we'll come to look at. But here it is standing fine after the towers went down. It's about 5:20 in the afternoon. Now, this building was not hit by a plane, mind you. So it's an excellent case study in collapse. Of structures like this. So here let's just watch it go down. The East Penthouse fails first in an isolated incident, and then 7 seconds later the entire building does this. Well, have we seen this before on TV, for instance, like the old hotels when they bring them down here in Las Vegas, in America? We see this quite often. Well, what does the official narrative from NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress to explain these collapses to the American people, what do they say? Shyam Sunder is the project leader there. Here he is.
What we found was that uncontrolled building fires caused an extraordinary event. The collapse of World Trade Center 7 was primarily due to fire.
Fires. Okay, well, let's look at those fires, shall we? These are the worst fires that we have any photographic or video evidence of in the building. And they are few, they are small, they are scattered, and they are burned out more than an hour before this building collapses at 5:20 in the afternoon, New York time. These are real fires in buildings. They're much harder, much larger, and much longer lasting in these buildings. Guess what? Not one of them has ever collapsed before or even after 9/11 in these fully engulfed buildings, one of which is in your town, Grenfell Tower.
Yep. Yeah, I recognize Grenfell Tower. And you're right, Richard, that building went up. But it stayed up. It didn't collapse.
None of them collapsed. No steel frame, fire protected high rise has ever collapsed due to fire. And we have dozens and dozens and dozens of them. It's pretty incredible. Now, let's see if there's any similarity here between a controlled demolition, a series of them on the right, building 7 on the left. Is there enough similarity, at least, to warrant an investigation into the possible use of explosives, especially since it looks exactly like a controlled demolition, especially since fire, the official cause of this building's collapse, has never in history brought down a steel frame fire-protected building?
Yeah, it's remarkable. It's
incredible. So let's look and just see, what does it have any of the 10 key characteristic features of controlled demolition? And what are they? Well, the first one's a sudden onset of destruction. Let's see. Let's listen to Dan Rather.
And what you're seeing are high shots. Now, here we're going to show you a videotape of the collapse itself.
Describe that.
Now we go to videotape the collapse of this building.
It's amazing.
Amazing, incredible, pick your word. For the third time today.
Oops, sorry about that. For the third time today, this is pretty important.
It's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
Wow.
Yeah.
Deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down? Dan, What are you talking about? He's using his intuition here, right? Like we all should. I mean, we see something, we just call it an apple. If it's an apple, we don't call it an orange, like NIST did. So is there a straight down symmetrical collapse into the building's footprint? Feature number two of controlled demolition. Let's look from West Street and see what we can learn. Yes, pretty straight down, pretty symmetrical.
Yeah,
it just doesn't get any more of that than this. How do you do that, David? You have to take out all 47 core columns within a fraction of a second of each other, followed a second later by the perimeter columns, and then repeat that on every floor. Any deviation in that pattern, the big building will begin to tip over. Mm. And there's plenty of examples of controlled demolitions that actually do tip over. Can these fires accomplish that symmetry? You know, that precision of timing. I mean, really, it doesn't get any more complicated than that. But there's just so much more. Like, for instance, how fast is the building coming down? Controlled demolitions come down very fast because all of their core columns and perimeter columns are taken out at once, instantly, resulting in the building falling, in this case, as fast as a bowling ball falling out of the sky. No structure underneath it. How do you do that? David Chandler documents here for us that this is actual free fall acceleration, meaning not one of the columns in this building gave any resistance for any of the, well, for a third of this building's fall. It was actually here in free fall, more than a third. So NIST actually is forced to acknowledge this after being publicly embarrassed in their own press conference by members of AE 9/11 Truth, the organization I founded 18 years ago. And they don't acknowledge, though, the implications of that free fall, which is, where did the structure go? You know, it's that simple.
Yeah.
It's that stupid, really, on their part, because it's obvious it just disappeared. You can only do that, of course, with controlled demolition, removing all core columns within a fraction of a second of each other, followed a second later by the perimeter columns. Feature number five, this results then in the complete dismemberment of the structural steel frame. This is a moment-resisting steel frame structure. So how does it all of a sudden collapse to 4 to 6 stories tall pile centered in the building's footprint, like a house of cards? It forms. So that can't happen without you know what, because buildings that fall due to natural causes,
they'll
fall over, right? You'll see a building certainly damaged, but the columns and beams are not severed one from another. The concrete is not pulverized to a fine powder. So how does that happen? Well, let's see if there's any witnesses of explosions. Here's Daryl, a medical student interviewed that evening in New York radio.
We were watching the building actually because it was on fire. The bottom floors of the building were on fire. And, you know, we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, we were shocked to see that the building was... well, it looked like there was a shockwave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out, and, you know, it was horrifying. And then, you know, about a second later, the bottom floor caved out, and the building followed after that, and we saw the building crash down all the way to the ground.
Wow. Well, that's helpful. How about Kevin McPadden, former Air Force medic, who is on hand as a first responder, and here's his experience.
You heard explosions, like boom. It's like a distinct sound. It's not like when in compression, like boom, 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 like floors that were dropping and collapsing. This was boom, and like you felt a rumble in the ground, like almost like you wanted to grab onto something. That, to me, I knew that was an explosion. There was no doubt in my mind.
nor the mind of Bill Rosati.
I was standing like two blocks away, and all of a sudden I just seen a big flash, and then I seen the building coming down, and I just seen people just running everywhere.
Okay. So he's seeing a flash. What's Captain Richard Patterson of the FDNY saying?
1-7 let go as well, and was also similar with, although not as loud because I was further away, a series of concussive explosions.
And Patrick Dillon, the first responder.
I remember feeling that, like it was like freight trains underneath the earth, shaking the earth, even shaking me. That's when we all saw Building 7 crumple in the middle, like way up at the top. It buckled and then dropped.
Okay, that's helpful too. Is there any examples of foreknowledge? Do people know that this building was going to come down before it did? Well, here's Chief Nick Visconti saying, we're going to move the command post over this way. That building's coming down. And there goes 7. So he knew, and most of the firefighters did know, because they were told. In fact, they were told by an engineer, because Chief Hayden asked, if we allow it to burn, could we anticipate a collapse and how soon? And the engineer says, well, in its current state, you have about 5 hours. Wait a minute. This is no steel frame fire protected structure has ever collapsed due to fire alone. And all of a sudden he's announcing the time of its collapse. This is pretty extraordinary. The prediction could only have been made with foreknowledge, of course, and the engineer remains anonymous. We never found out or will find out who he is or was, or why, how he became psychic. How about these construction workers hearing an explosion over their shoulder, looking back at the building, then looking straight into the CNN camera and saying this?
We are looking back. There's a building about to blow up.
What? The building is about to blow up? Flame and debris coming down? How do they know that this building, which has a few small scattered fires, is about to blow up? And what else did they experience, these first responders? This is Patrick Dillon.
All right. And he pointed to what turned out to be the entrance to Building 7's lobby. He said, go in there, take a break. Take a break. There's other guys in there like that. And that's what I did. I finished coming down off the pile and climbed over the wreckage of Vesey and went into those revolving doors and just kind of fell on the floor. There were other guys in there doing the same thing I was, just shaking their heads and spitting out poison and trying to get their, you know, get their lungs back together again, as I was. And I was on the floor. These battalion chiefs come in through the revolving doors. There was three of them. They had the white helmets. I didn't get any IDs off them. But as soon as they stepped inside, what stepped in behind them were these two people in black with black ski masks on and Uzis. And the Uzis were, you know, hanging off their necks. And I don't know what they were or who they were, but the battalion chiefs started yelling at us, right? Ordering us to get out of this building. They're going to pull the building, everybody out now. And they ordered us back out.
Well, that's some interesting language. And Captain Patterson,
so I made
also
our way over to the entrance of the building. Before we arrived there, there was a construction worker who happened to be, he emerged from the dust cloud and walked past the chief and I. And he said he had overheard the chief's comment, and he paused and said, that'll be coming down around 5 o'clock.
So this story gets real interesting. But Kevin McPadden, before he heard those explosions, he and others were held back about several blocks away from Building 7. And he's listening to a radio held in the hands of a Red Cross worker, and this is what he hears.
At the last few seconds, he took his hand off, and you heard 3, 2, 1.
Oh, do fires bring buildings down to countdowns? What's really going on here?
Yeah.
In your quarter, we have the BBC announcing this collapse. When? Let's listen.
Now, more on the latest building collapse in New York. You might have heard a few moments ago was talking about the Salomon Brothers building collapsing. And indeed it has. Apparently that's only a few hundred yards away from where the World Trade Center towers were. And it seems that this was not a result of a new attack. It was because the building had been weakened during this morning's attacks. We'll probably find out more now about that from our correspondent, Jane Stanley. Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy.
Wait a minute. You've announced, sketchy indeed,
you've
announced the collapse of a building 20 minutes before it even happened?
Yeah. I gotta say, Richard, that's one that I find completely inexplicable. It doesn't make sense, does it?
No. They apologize for that grievous error, citing the confusing events of the day.
No. Okay.
Does that make them psychic? What's really going on here?
Yeah.
Not to be outdone, CNN announced the collapse of the building. In fact, 7, I can do the math, almost 7 hours before it happened. Look at this.
In New York, Alan Dodds Frank joins us on the phone in Lower Manhattan. Alan?
Alan, just 2 or 3 minutes ago, there was yet another collapse or explosion. I'm now out of sight. A Good Samaritan has taken me in on Duane Street. But at 10:45, there was another collapse or explosion following the 10:30 collapse of the second tower. And a firefighter who rushed by us estimated that 50 stories went down. The street filled with smoke. It was like a fire, forest fire roaring down.
Wait a minute. No other 50 or 40-story building went down that day. No building went down completely. There were some damaged buildings when the towers issued their columns, destroying skyscrapers, not destroying them, but damaging them. Mm-hmm. So if had that building gone down at that time, 15 minutes after the towers, it would have been completely obscured by the massive dust cloud released by the Twin Towers when they went down. We wouldn't even have video of it today. So many 9/11 researchers suspect that it was supposed to go down at that time and then didn't. It was a dud. But those mysterious construction workers may have been sent into that building to fix the dud, and coming out of the building talking to the CNN camera, telling us it's going to blow up. Is that how they knew? So that's a likely scenario. But what we do know is that Larry Silverstein also adds an interest. To very lucky to the puzzle, as he's interviewed a year later about Building 7's collapse.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull. And then we watched the building collapse.
So he made a decision to pull the building. Well, he says they made the decision, but firefighters don't make decisions to pull buildings. And they don't go into burning buildings. Nobody does, to set explosives in them either. This was obviously pre-planned. Yeah. What do the experts say?
Danny Jowenko is the expert on this in Europe. What did he say?
This is controlled demolition.
Zeker weten.
Er is nasprongen. Dit is in opdracht gebeurd. Het heeft een team gedaan van experts.
Wow. And about 24 structural engineers signed on to the petition also, like Kamal Obaid. A localized failure in a steel frame building like WTC7 cannot cause a catastrophic collapse like a house of cards without a simultaneous and patterned loss of several of its columns at key locations within the building. And so does that sound like something that those fires can do? No.
Yeah.
We have commissioned the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country. In fact, Professor Leroy Halsey, the chair of that department, there to conduct a finite element analysis, testing whether NIST's theory has merit, because he was interested because, gosh, if there's hundreds of buildings that are similarly designed, how can we just ignore this? They should all be evaluated, right?
Yeah.
Well, he does analysis of the steel based on fire modeling as well. The study that NIST did on the right is NIST's computer model, 400 structural steel connections failing every second. They still can't get the building to fall down, as the video shows in the middle. In fact, their model begins to fall over after crumpling up like a beer can. Looks nothing like the actual video of the collapse.
Yeah.
Whereas the University of Alaska says, okay, well, what do we have to do? Because they first said, gosh, if we take out the column 79, 80, 81 in the northeast corner of the building falls over. And that was NIST theory, which is why their model begins to fall over. But no, once they take out all the columns in the building, it does behave exactly like. So their conclusion is fire did not cause the collapse of Building 7. The temperatures were not hot enough to cause the weakening of the steel framing. Thermal expansion did not result in a loss of support for the beams and girders, and the building didn't experience a progressive collapse, as claimed by NIST, but a global collapse caused by the near simultaneous failure of all of its columns. This is pretty darn important, and this has been out now for more than 3 years, and we have been trying to get it through the academic circles and in the media, but it is crickets out there. They do not want to respond to this.
Yeah.
What could have brought this building down? And the Twin Towers, for that matter, because we're looking for evidence of ignited thermite. What do the officials support us with? Well, how about a metallurgical examination in the Building Performance Assessment Team report of FEMA's that came out in May of 2002? It's in Appendix C. It's an analysis of the steel. What do they find? Never before observed eutectic reactions, intergranular melting, solid steel girder turning into Swiss cheese, like this piece of World Trade Center 7 steel, the end of a beam. Fires don't do this to steel. Office fires are only about 500-600 degrees typically Fahrenheit. Yeah. Double that for Celsius or so. And, half it for Celsius. So steel doesn't begin to melt like this until 2800 degrees Fahrenheit. What, 1100, 1300 degrees Celsius. So we also have rapid oxidation, sulfidation, liquid iron, that's molten iron. There's no accounting in the official narrative whatsoever. The temperature's only a quarter hot enough to melt steel. Where are these temperatures coming from? They're completely ignored in the NIST report. Hot corrosion attack on the steel. Sulfur forming. They have no source for the sulfur. They don't even know where it might have come from. Steel members in the debris pile appear to have been partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures. It takes 4,000 degrees to evaporate steel. What? About 2,000 Celsius.
Yeah.
So we have the melting of girders. This structural engineer saw them, documented them in the World Trade Center, but he doesn't know how it happened. Well, let's look at what they're pulling up from the debris pile in the crab claw excavators, molten material pouring out of the crab claw. And we have temperatures because we know what the temperatures of molten metals are by their color. And so in this case, we're exceeding 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, 1,371 degrees Celsius. Wow. How are we getting those temperatures? the office fires and even jet fuel, according to its manufacturer, ME Petroleum, only burns about 600 degrees Fahrenheit, 300 degrees Celsius open air. So they're, again, completely swept under the rug. Any evidence of ignited incendiaries in the World Trade Center dust, though? Because the USGS did studies in 2005. They produced the Particle Atlas of the World Trade Center dust. Billions is what they find of previously molten iron microspheres. Billions of them. Well, what are these? They're previously molten, meaning they're hot enough, exceeding 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, half of that Celsius or so. They're iron. We haven't used iron in our skyscrapers for 100 years. Where's all this elemental iron coming from? So that turns out to be the byproduct of thermite, an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. And they're spherical. We'll talk about that in a moment, how they get spherical. Billions of them, about naked, almost naked to the human eye. They're real small. But there's up to 4 tons of them. Up to 6% of some of these samples are previously molten iron microspheres.
It's a huge amount,
The EPA says this is ubiquitous. In fact, we're going to call this a signature component to distinguish World Trade Center dust from common office building dust. But we don't know what they are or where they came from. RJ Lee doesn't know where they came from. They know when they came. They're formed during the event, not before, by the iron workers putting the building together, not afterward by the iron workers taking the building apart, but during the event. This is an internationally known engineering, environmental engineering consulting firm. Well, let's see where they might have come from. Here's a thermite experiment. Producing what look like billions of or thousands of sparks, but which are molten iron microspheres, which cool and fall back into the pan. How do they get round? Spherical. Well, that's just the surface tension of droplets that are aerosolized. They form themselves into spheres. That's what raindrops are, actually. Could that be what's responsible for the toasting of the tops of these cars in this very high heat event? Cars parked all around the World Trade Center. I mean, this is not paper falling on these cars and doing this. Molten iron droplets could. And that makes sense. There's no other accounting for it in the official narrative. Well, what else is found in the dust? Any evidence of unignited thermite? Because that was all evidence of ignited thermite. Can only be that.
Yeah.
Well, a team of 8 international scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen are sent 7 independently collected samples of dust. In them, they find these red-gray chips, red on one side, gray on the other. They look like paint chips, but they certainly do, but they're attracted by a magnet, so they have a high iron content. Well, this is interesting. What do? They X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy on the red layer, finding what? Aluminum and iron, elemental iron again. These are the ingredients of thermite, the incendiary used by the military. What is that doing in all of these chips? They get real curious. Zoom in 50,000 times with an electron microscope. What do they find? Rhomboidal-shaped iron oxide crystals and aluminum platelets, the size of 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. Nanoparticles of thermite set in a bed of oxygen, silica, carbon, organic material, which expands rapidly and knocks things over when used in high energy explosives. So we have something very special here. It's called super thermite. It was developed by Lawrence Livermore Lab prior to 9/11. In their studies, they put these chips also in a differential scanning calorimeter And what happens? They ignite, producing a lot of energy. Well, that's exactly what happened with the samples that the team of scientists, when they put their chips in their scanning calorimeter, proving that this is exothermic material. It's not paint. Paint doesn't do this.
Yeah.
Okay. And what happens when they ignite, though? They produce molten iron microspheres with the same chemical signature as the molten iron microspheres produced by the spheres it found in the lab by the U.S. Geological Survey and R.J. Lee. So we know exactly where those molten iron microspheres came from. They came from these chips. As if we didn't know, they're found attached to partially ignited red-gray chips, as you see here and here.
Yeah, I see that.
This is a very sophisticated material. It's not made in a cave in Afghanistan.
No, I didn't think so.
This is made only in the most advanced defense contracting laboratories. So a real criminal investigator could find out exactly where this material came from and who did it. Because the peer-reviewed paper is 24 pages in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal. And they've determined that the red layer is unreacted thermitic material, not paint, incorporating nanotechnology and is a highly energetic or pyrotechnic material. This paper stands uncontested. Nobody submitted their own peer-reviewed paper and contested the results. That's what you do with a conspiracy theory or something you want to and can, if it's possible, challenge, but it hasn't been done. And so that, along with the 10 key characteristic features of controlled demolition, some very uncharacteristic features with the use of incendiaries, was direct evidence of destruction with incendiaries and explosives. Mm-hmm. No, fire can't create any one of these features, let alone all 10 of them. So with additional circumstantial corroborative evidence and testimony that we go into in our 2-hour presentation on Building 7, we find this to be proof of controlled demolition, a body of proof that's convinced thousands of architects and engineers to demand a new investigation, many of which will appear in the film, which we are producing, 9/11 Crime Scene to Courtroom, an unprecedented film taking the hard evidence of 9/11 crimes to court. We're going to be giving this to the U.S. attorney to supplement the 60 exhibits we've already given him in the lower Manhattan district, Southern District of New York. And so the grand jury investigation will now have a whole series, piece of evidence by piece of evidence that we've been looking at, and a whole lot more to do, to reevaluate, to determine who should be brought in for questioning. And Mick Harrison has been filmed along with myself in Washington, D.C. We're now in the post-edit process. We're editing the film. We need more funds for this process, and we encourage everybody to be involved and co-produce this film. We're trying to raise the final $50,000 of this project now. The first episode will be coming out within a month if we achieve, if we have everybody's help. So I encourage you to be personally involved in this process, because we have to get the evidence out. We looked at the evidence for Building 7. It's clear, convincing, irrefutable, overwhelming forensic evidence. And guess what? We have to ask ourselves, if that's what happened at Building 7, is it possible that we could have a similar convincing set of evidence at the World Trade Center? Well, we've already looked at the extreme heat.
Hang on, Richard, in your enthusiasm, let me just a slight pause there. I think that what you've presented with regard to Building 7 is pretty comprehensive and pretty indisputable and extremely disturbing, because it makes it absolutely, the evidence is clear, isn't it? I mean, it was a controlled demolition, which raises obvious questions, which we'll talk about in a wee bit. But yeah, I think that's very, very comprehensive, Richard. And I hope everybody listening to that found it as persuasive as I did, because you've presented the facts. The facts are facts. You can't argue with facts. Yeah, so okay, let's move on then. So World Trade Center 7, Building 7, yep, Twin Towers.
Well, let's look at them both. The North Tower and the South Tower side by side, though their destruction was 15 minutes apart. Here we see that they are, in fact, identical. They had different sets of damage from the planes and the fires. But we have here upward, outward arching streamers, a geometry of fireworks, freely flying structural steel sections, weighing 4 and 8 tons, ejected laterally 600 feet at 80 miles an hour. It looks more like a volcanic eruption with thousands of explosions. And we're going to show just that. It's extraordinary. As we look at the features one by one, let's start with a sudden onset, because it starts very differently than it ends. It starts, it's still, and then all of a sudden it's in uniform downward motion, the North Tower. No jolt, no hesitation upon impacting the cold, hard steel below, which we would expect. Same with the South Tower. It's still, and all of a sudden, it's in uniform downward motion. It doesn't hesitate as it collides with the intact structure below. This tells us, well, the upper part was so heavy that it drove the rest of the building down to the ground and then destroyed itself. Well, wait a minute. Is that even possible? Now, Zdenek Bazant of Northwestern University in Chicago studied this for 2 days following 9/11 and produced the most advanced piece of mathematical wizardry ever produced that took engineers 10 years to decode. And he did it all in 2 days. They call it the crush down, crush up theory. The rest of us were in shock trying to find out. We're under attack for the first time in our country from a seemingly foreign adversary. We don't know when the next building is going to be hit. We don't know who's responsible for this. We're working really hard to get answers to our questions. Yep. Well, this guy's in his den developing the thesis, the theory that gave NIST their column failure theory, their crush down, crush up theory, their pile driver theory, their pancaking theory. They have a lot of different names for it over time. But whatever it was, she thought I said Siri and I said theory. That's funny. So it violates Newton's third law of motion completely. What is that? There's an equal and opposite destruction when two bodies collide. Run a Mack truck, a lorry into a Volkswagen. What happens? The Volkswagen gets crushed, right? Does it matter if we drop the Volkswagen onto the lorry? No. The weakest part, the lightest part of a structure cannot possibly destroy the cold, hard, heavier, intact steel below. It's very light at the top, you know, less than an inch. And then it gets heavier and heavier and heavier and bigger and bigger and bigger until at mid-height, you're 36 inches by 16 inches. And then heavier and heavier and heavier until down at the bottom, you're almost solid steel, 52 inches by 22 inches. It's an incredible structure. It's not going to be destroyed by the lightest part. And guess what? It doesn't happen that way. Watch yourself. The top part is telescoping in on itself. It's not moving the rest of the structure down. Let me make it easier for you. Watch the lower red line. The lower red line doesn't move down until now. The top part is destroying itself. The question is, what's destroying it? So we have a lot of questions here. If it were there, by the way, we'd see it in the photographs and the videos. It looks more like the volcanic eruption in the Tongan Sea. Again, upward, outward arching streamers, geometry of fireworks freely falling, flying solid objects that are molten, trailed by thick white smoke clouds.
Yeah.
Where are the thick white smoke clouds coming from, trailing these solid steel objects? Steel structures, the steel structure is not flammable like wood. So again, it takes 2,800 degrees to even begin to melt or ignite steel. So or iron, what's happening here? Well, thermite, which we've shown already, would eject. There's a chemical reaction where the aluminum oxide ash is produced, trailing this burn pattern. So that's what we're looking at here, is aluminum oxide ash. And by the way, if that upper part were driving the rest of the building down to the ground, it would have destroyed these few remaining columns in the spire that we see remaining for 7 seconds, standing 1,000 feet in the air, until it also receives yet another explosion and descends frame by frame straight down through the concrete powder that's been shaken off of it, as we see right here. So it's not turning to dust, as some claim. It's descending through the powder very clearly.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, so Zdenek Bezant's theory is all wrong. It's not this, the top part crushing. It's a set of explosions, thousands of them, blowing the building out. And then it goes down as it goes out, and leaving this spire intact. So the Zdenek Bezant theory, which is the support for the NIST report, the key theoretical support for the NIST report, is found. It's completely failed, in fact, all on its own. Let me bring this one up. And so we're just, there we go. The NIST report was, by the way, tasked with explaining the collapse of these buildings. As you can begin to see, it did not do that at all.
No.
And so that's why, you know, other people like us and millions of people in the 9/11 truth movement have to do that. Feature number two, are there witnesses of explosions like we saw at Building 7? Well, it turns out that there's the oral histories of the first responders recorded just a month after 9/11, within a month. Not 118, as Graham McQueen first found, witnesses of explosions, not 156, but now 186 witnesses of explosions like this one. We felt the ground shake. You could see the towers sway, and then it just came down. He read 12,000 pages of these testimonies, and he found that 186 of them are very much like this. All of a sudden, the ground just started shaking. Felt like a train running under my feet. The next thing we know, we look up, and the tower's collapsing. Mm-hmm. It actually shook my bones shortly before. This order of events is extremely important. The first tower came down before that. I remember feeling the ground shaking. I heard a terrible noise, and then debris just started flying everywhere, because NIST tells us that these sounds that they were hearing was a sound of the building coming down. No, I saw flash, flash, flash. You know, like when they demolish a building? With each popping sound, initially an orange, and then a red flash came out of the building, and then it would just go all around the building on both sides. Saw a number of brief light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. He saw about 6 of these brief flashes, accompanied by a crackling sound, before the tower collapsed. I saw low-level flashes. I saw flash, 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 and then it looked like the building came down. You ever see professional demolition where they set these charges on certain floors and you hear the pop, pop, pop? When I heard that friggin' noise, that's when I saw the building come down. An explosion appeared at the very top. Simultaneously, from all four sides, material shot out horizontally. And then there seemed to be a momentary delay before you could see the beginning of the collapse. How clear does it need to be? There was an explosion in the South Tower. When it hit about the fifth floor, I figured it was a bomb because it looked like a deliberate, synchronized kind of thing. Seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings, seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt. All these explosions. The building was blowing out on all four sides. We actually heard the pops. You know, you heard the pops of the building. I thought the terrorist planted explosives somewhere in the building. That's how loud it was. A crackling explosive. Another loud boom at the upper floors. Then a series of smaller explosions, which appeared to go completely around the building at the upper floors. You get the idea. This testimony is absolutely incredible. Is there a straight down symmetrical collapse? Well, we'll look. But the South Tower begins to fall off. In fact, it's falling off at 20 degrees.
Yeah.
So there's asymmetrical loading from this piece, which is falling off the building. Asymmetrical damage from the fires. Asymmetrical damage from the planes. How in the world, then, do we get complete symmetrical damage all the way around all four sides of the building, just like the firefighters described? It makes no sense, given what's going on up above. Yeah. But if you zoom in to the leading corner of these explosions, we see them even more clearly in this looped video. I count about a dozen individual, fairly small, on the order of things, explosions, meaning this is not a nuclear weapon going off, right? These are individual, pre-placed, synchronized explosions. It can only be that. And we can see dozens of them in isolated on the left side of the South Tower. It's beginning to lean to the right. So its structural rigidity is being compromised by these explosions inside of it. And that's why it doesn't actually maintain its rigidity, reacting to the rigid object below and fall off the building. It's kind of liquefies, if you will, and settles back into it. How fast is the building coming down? David Chandler notes that this is coming down almost at free fall acceleration. It's not slowing down as it meets all of that steel below it, 80,000 tons below it of intact structural steel, right? It's not. That's an incredible quantity of steel in the core as well. 47 massive core columns, 287 columns altogether. Well, what's happening to that steel? It's being laterally ejected. A feature that we're going to call feature number 7 of this, these twin towers collapse. Laterally ejecting the steel, embedding them in skyscrapers all around, destroying the Winter Garden 600 feet away. 4- and 8-ton structural steel sections ejected at 80 miles an hour laterally up to 600 feet. We can see them individually freely flying in this series of ejections. And there are thousands of them. This one's about to hit Building 7. Back to forward to. What are we looking at? Back to. That's horizontal. Gravity works how? Down. What's going on here? 4 tons ejected explosively laterally. And then gravity takes over. It begins to fall. In a semi-vertical fashion. There's enough energy here to hurl a 200-pound cannonball 3 miles. And it's well beyond the boundary of World Trade Center site itself. It's 1,200 feet in every direction, destroying the Winter Gardens here to the left. This is an incredibly explosive event. And by the way, if 100,000 tons of steel framing, or about 95 or 98% of it, is distributed outside the footprint, we have to ask ourselves the question, is it available to crush the building? It can't be crushing the building.
No,
this is half the weight of the building almost. So what's crushing the building if it's not half the weight of the building in the steel? Maybe it's the concrete, because we have 110 concrete floors, each an acre in size. But at the bottom, we don't find 50 of them. We don't find 10 of them. We're looking for these. Concrete poured over metal decking over lightweight steel trusses. Where are they? There's only a 3, 4, 5 story pile of miscellaneous metal here. There should be 80,000 tons, 100,000 tons of structural steel. Where did it go? On the right, excuse me, that's the steel, but also the concrete. We should see a stack of 110 pancakes. We don't find 50. We don't even find 1 acre size, 4 and 8 inch thick concrete slabs. On the right, we have a real gravitational collapse. Where did it go? It's missing. Oh, there it is. It's pulverized in midair. All the photos, all the videos show exactly that. 90,000 tons of concrete pulverized to 100 micron particles and distributed laterally outside the footprint of the building. In fact, across lower Manhattan in a three square mile area in a blanket of dust, powdered concrete, 4 inches thick. Well, wait a minute. If 90,000 tons of concrete, almost the other half of the weight of the building, by the way,
yes, yeah,
is spread out over 3 square miles, what's crushing the building? It wasn't the steel. It's not the concrete. But wait a minute. What is the weight in this upper section that is told to us by Zdenek Bezant in his incredibly complex paper, The Crush Down, Crush Up Theory that NIST adopted? What's the problem with it? It didn't include the concrete, it included all of the concrete and steel, which wasn't there. In fact, they doubled the mass up above, and they decreased the column strength below by a factor of 3. The entire mathematical calculation was rigged fraudulently in favor of a collapse. So we've got to get real. And there has been a challenge to this peer-reviewed paper by Tony Zambodi and others. And the American Society of Civil Engineers rejected it because it was out of scope. How can it be out of scope to provide a paper challenges the false assumptions of the paper before it? That's the whole point of peer-reviewed paper, right?
Agreed. Yeah.
Well, could thermite have been applied in the building during a fireproofing upgrade? Research done by Kevin Ryan in digwithin.net, because he found that fireproofing upgrades were occurring right at the point of jet plane impacts. Coincidental? Could that be an undercover operation to provide under the guise of fireproofing to provide nanothermite? Entirely possible. It needs to be researched. But what about the evidence? We have easily the largest and most perplexing structure failures in history. But 400 truckloads a day were lined up just 2 weeks after 9/11 to cart it away to the landfill to be put on barges and sent to China for recycling. This is the illegal destruction of evidence in a crime scene, prompting Bill Manning, editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering Magazine, to cry out crucial evidence that can answer many questions is on the slow boat to China, showing an astounding ignorance of government officials to the value of a thorough scientific investigation. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately. But it wasn't.
Yeah.
And so with all of this evidence, including its destruction, is the 10 key characteristic features and some very uncharacteristic features with nanothermite incendiaries. Direct evidence of destruction with explosives and incendiaries, none of which can be accounted for in the official narrative. With additional circumstantial corroborative evidence and testimony, this also becomes proof of controlled demolition, a body of proof that's convinced thousands of architects, again, 30,000 years of technical expertise, to demand a new investigation, many of whom appear in our new documentary film series, 9/11 Crime Scene to Courtroom, an unprecedented film series taking the hard evidence of 9/11 crimes to court. And in we also have our documentary with all those experts in it, 40 of them, high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, chemists, physicists, control demolition experts, all laying out the evidence. In 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. And the film 7 by Dylan Avery about the study of the Hulsey Report, and who did the analysis on Building 7. And then a 15-minute, excellent mini-documentary narrated by actor Ed Asner on Building 7. And the brochure that outlines all of this evidence is on our website. People can download it for free and print it and give it to every architect and engineer you can find. Everybody else that you know has to be aware of this evidence, because what are the ramifications? I mean, look, we have Brown University doing an incredible study finding the costs of the 9/11 wars, probably 2 million dead, 38 million displaced, 7,000 U.S. soldiers killed, and almost as many in Europe, and 30,000 suicides since 9/11. $2 trillion in care going to the surviving U.S. vets, $14 trillion in the longest American war in history, Afghanistan, and $8 trillion in the other post-9/11 wars.
Yeah.
We've got to get to the bottom. What?
Yeah, the thing about that, though, that if you go back, could you go back to that slide a second? Yeah, I mean, as you say, Richard, you know, the post-9/11 wars, $8 trillion. And, of course, the thing about wars is some people make lots of money from wars now, don't they? And furthermore, you know, as you rightly point out, Richard, this changed so much. Freedom was taken away. Liberty was compromised, all in the name of the war on a guy in a cave in Afghanistan who had, I think he had a Nokia phone. Using a Nokia, an old Nokia phone, he was able to, we were asked to believe, yeah, that's how they planned all of this. Can I, you know, yes, it's staggering. It's absolutely amazing. Amazing, Richard.
Oh, tell me about it. We have the Patriot Act here in America, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012. We've lost our civil liberties. Any of us could be arrested. We can be arrested without a right to a lawyer, a trial, a jury. Mm-hmm. We can be tortured, actually, and even assassinated.
Yep.
And all of that is legal, they say. No, it's completely unconstitutional. It violates your own laws. What was it that gave you your fundamental set of rights, not constitution, but
yeah, I mean, we
medieval times.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but I mean, can I have a few questions I'd like to ask Richard, if I may?
Well, yeah, let me just run this through, and then we'll stop. Yeah. So we got to get to the bottom of the 9/11 issue because it paints a picture, as we'll talk about, with regard to other succeeding false flag operations like COVID, which we'll get into. So where do we draw our line in the sand? Do we wait for the next one? Well, guess what? It already happened the last 3 years, right? No, we got to speak the truth about 9/11. Even though we have a small voice, look what a small voice can accomplish.
Boom.
Very good.
That was 13 dominoes. If I had 29 dominoes, the last domino would be as tall as the Empire State Building.
And that's what we're looking at. The deep state is that powerful, but we collectively working together can accomplish this. If each of us, for instance, sends this podcast to just two people and ask them to send it to two others after they watch it and see the evidence for themselves, we can definitely take down this massive apparatus. There's billions of us. There's a few hundred thousand of them, max. Yep.
That's right. So true.
That's what I wanted to bring to your attention today.
Yeah, we outnumber them massively, absolutely massively. The difficulty for us is, I think, Richard, they've controlled the mainstream media. They've been able to control, you know, the press, all of that. They've been able to control social media as well to a significant degree. And so that's why it's so much harder for us to get the truth out there and to ask these very critical questions. But a question I have, like, everything you've said, I can follow the logic. It's really clear. I think it's pretty, you know, compelling. What was the need? The planes on the 9/11, the planes that hit the Twin Towers. Did planes hit the Twin Towers? And was that to provide a cover? What do you think about that? Because that's a bit that seems a bit disjarred to me, the use of the so-called commercial aircraft in this situation.
Well, that's the pretext. They didn't need the planes to bring the towers down. No, they needed the planes to not be blamed for a controlled demolition. And yes, we do have plenty of evidence that the planes did hit the towers.
Yep.
We don't actually have evidence, solid evidence as to who may have been on those planes. Most 9/11 researchers suggest that the planes were switched out and remotely guided, switched with military planes that they could more accurately control. Mm-hmm. That's not my area of research, but it's really important. But so that's why we focus on the explosive demolition, because it is so irrefutable.
I think so. I think, you know, looking at the way, I love the way you've sort of combined video side by side, so we can, you know, you don't have to be a very experienced architect or an engineer just to see the evidence of your own eyes. I mean, there's people asking lots of different questions. I mean, the evidence that you provide, I think, is compelling in terms of. So they were controlled demolitions, basically, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. And some, like Judy Wood, has suggested that they are directed energy weapons. But in her book, she denies the evidence of explosions, which we showed so much evidence for in eyewitness testimony. She denies the evidence of nanothermite. And thermite and incendiaries, which we've shown so much evidence of. She denies the evidence of extreme heat, which we've shown evidence of 2 and 3,000 degree Fahrenheit temperatures, extraordinary heat here. So, and instead of all of that, she suggests a theory, energy weapons, for which there's literally no evidence. So I have reason to suspect the intentions of somebody who denies irrefutable, overwhelming evidence and forensic testimony, eyewitness testimony, and then provides a theory that is just so flimsy and just confuses people.
And if they set up that both the Twin Towers, that those buildings would have been prepped then, wouldn't they? They would have had to be prepped at all the different levels so that then, you know, so there would have been a lot of planning gone into this, Richard. It would have been, you know, so that's, somebody was very engaged to make sure this happened.
Well,
this,
let's talk about it. There's it would take months of planning. Well, interestingly, we have the elevator modernization, the largest one of its kind ever, going on the 9 months prior to 9/11, which would have given a group of operatives, specifically 85 employees of Ace Elevator, who had this contract and came out of nowhere to steal it from Otis Elevator, who had installed and maintained these elevators. But they had access to all the core columns in the buildings between which the elevator shafts rise. And they did have 85 employees at that time, that morning in the building, but they fled. And this is a scandal documented in USA Today, actually. So there's 2 inches of gypsum board around each of these elevator hoistways to control fire. And but that's a lot of, so they had to do is saw through that. to get to the beam, the columns and beams outside the hoistway. And we do have complaints in the months before 9/11 of powder coming through the ventilation shafts, getting on people's desks. So that's very interesting. So we want an investigation, not only Ace Elevator, but the security company, Securicom, Stratasec, who had the security contract up to the day, curiously, of 9/11.
Yeah.
And whose board members included members of the Bush family. So we certainly want an investigation there too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I can understand the symbolism of, if you take down the Twin Towers, completely iconic New York landmark, and many people from other parts of the world, I mean, I've been there and whatnot. I can understand the significance of that destruction if you were a nefarious individuals, let's call it like that, who wanted it taken down. But Building 7, what would have been the logic to take down Building 7? You know, it's not the same, is it?
Well, the Larry Silverstein was the primary owner of and developer of Building 7 in the 80s. Mm. Interestingly, 6 weeks prior to 9/11, he acquired the other six buildings of the World Trade Center in a private deal. They were public from the Port Authority. So for the first time in history, it transferred to private hands, put massive insurance on all seven buildings. And then he walked away with $5.68 billion after investing literally only $15 million of his own money.
That's why they call him Lucky Larry, isn't it?
Well, he is also lucky because the city of New York was requiring him to, well, the Port Authority before him, to abate the massive asbestos problem in the World Trade Center buildings, all of them. And they couldn't do that. It would be a $15 billion project. So it's many times the value of the structures themselves. So did he know that in 6 weeks he was going to have his free asbestos abatement at the cost of the health and lives of New Yorkers?
Yeah. You see, I think the thing is the sheer brutality of what happened on that day, all those lives that were lost on that day, I think that was such a massive emotional blast, never mind the actual physical detonations that took place, that it kind of provided perfect subterfuge, Richard. You know, so many people, like, I remember watching the whole thing and just sitting horrified, really, and not you're in those situations. And it became very similar during COVID as well. You're almost so emotionally captured that the capacity to critically think it's hard to do it in the moment. And it was, don't you think?
It was impossible for me. I was watching on TV in 2001. As these towers were coming down, and I just kind of remember feeling a state of shock.
Yeah.
And then these buildings are blowing up in front of my face like a mushroom cloud, a volcano. And yet they're telling us this is a collapse, and I just couldn't think. We're under attack after all, too. So that initial fear primes us to not think and then to accept, because we're looking for escape from that pain, that fear, and we take authority at their word at that point. And massively across the 90,000 members of the American Institute of Architects, most all of us just bought the official narrative. What else could we think? I could have never imagined our own government lying to us on this scale. That was hard to come around to also in 2006, when I felt my worldview just kind of turning upside down as I was listening to this evidence on the radio from David Ray Griffin.
Yeah.
And I just felt no, don't, this cannot be true. And I sought to prove it not to be true. And I did, it ended up doing just the opposite.
Yes.
And I looked around and I said, there's no other architects calling this out. These are buildings. And so it just fell on my shoulders to organize the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. Yeah. And I've been at it 18 years since, now on my own with my wonderful wife, Gail. Yeah. We're working together, 85 podcasts, dozens and dozens, and this is just in the last year, speaking engagements and many, many more radio interviews. We're going strong. I think COVID has begun to wake people up because they're saying, yeah. Oh gosh, well, what else have we been lied to? Well, then now they're open to 9/11, right?
That's it. Well, a couple of other quick questions. Well, a couple of years before 9/11, wasn't there a so-called attempted attack on the TARS? Some explosion went off, I think, in the underground car park.
In 1993, there was a conspiracy to blow up the towers with an explosion from a truck bomb down in the basement. And court documents have shown that, in fact, the FBI informant was fully aware that and provided the actual bomb. This came out in court, but the media just didn't pick it up.
No.
So it is also an inside job.
The thing I've come to understand, Richard, so much over the last 4 years, but it goes back to 9/11, and actually I would argue it goes back even further in history than that, is that the people that we should be most afraid of don't reside in caves in Afghanistan or other far-flung parts of the world. They reside in Washington, D.C. They reside in London. They reside in Brussels. They reside amongst us. And the thing is, I think they're so psychopathic that they can consider doing these things which decent people like us would never, ever dream of. And we saw that with COVID as well. Big Pharma wouldn't collude to potentially kill, you know, half the population of the world. Well, it might actually, it turns out, you know. So that's why I think when you go back to 9/11, and you've presented this masterfully, I may say, it all kind of falls into place for me, Richard. You know, they will do these things, but it's the sheer, the horror of what happened in New York. But another question. So what happened in Washington then? If the towers were brought down by controlled demolition and Building 7 was brought down by controlled demolition, what happened at the Pentagon?
Well, we have Hani Hanjour, who failed Cessna Flying School and was put in that flying school by the CAA.
Yeah.
Allegedly flying this 767, Flight 77,
yes,
in a maneuver that's attributed to jet aircraft, military.
Yeah.
Jets,
flying
270 degree corkscrew turn before coming into the Pentagon, descending 3,000 feet per minute, and flying just a few feet above the ground, and then hitting where? Not Donald Rumsfeld's office, which would be an easy target from the air, right? The huge Pentagon through the vulnerable roof structure, but no, striking the Naval Intelligence Department that was, and others, tasked with finding the $2.3 trillion that Donald Rumsfeld had just announced the night before was missing and unaccountable for in the Pentagon budget. So they never let a crisis go to waste. That just wiped out any memory of that acknowledgement on Donald Rumsfeld's part, and brought in the goals of the Project for a New American Century, a neocon think tank, which established in their paper Rebuilding America's Defenses and put on their website, pnac.org, their goals, which was a vast increase in the military budget, regional hegemony in the Middle East, the capability to fight two independent wars simultaneously. But they said in that paper, absent a catalyzing and catastrophic event like a new Pearl Harbor, these goals will likely take a long time. So,
right.
And Bush writes in his diary, today we had our new Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah. Well, we could talk about Pearl Harbor as well if we wanted, but that can save for another time. Listen, we're going to run out of time on Twitter. So before we run out of time, can I just bring up, Richard, with regard to your fundraiser? So, look, this is the page that you go to. And there you can see you can help Richard out. Please provide support, financial support, so we can get this important documentary brought to air. So I would urge everyone to do that. You can find Richard, obviously, over at richardgage911.org. It's a fantastic resource. You can find out about upcoming speaking events that Richard's going to be doing as well. And I hope, Richard, as I said, time's always a wee bit tight, but I've tried to give as much time as I can. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. And I'd love to have you back at another time, if convenient, and we can talk. There's other things we could have talked about. We could get into that as well, because I know you put it like this, you got loads of content on your website. I think it's really interesting, really fascinating. And I think you've put together a superb presentation. It's an absolute pleasure to have met you. Thanks. And thanks to Gail as well for helping pull all this together. Gail, I appreciate your efforts as well. Richard, lovely to meet you. And look, on behalf of everybody, a big thank you to Richard. You can follow him on X at richardgage.com/911. You can see it there. There's his page. We've put up his website, all the links. Go and support him. Give as much help as you can, folks. And we do need to get to the truth, Richard, of actually what happened on that infamous day in history.
Let's do it.
Let's do so, and let's hope we can help you, Richard. Listen, everyone, thank you so much for your time. Thanks you on all the different platforms. If you're watching this in replay, do make sure that you do help as much as you can as well. I'll be back on Wednesday night with another live show, 8 o'clock, with David Scott talking about hate crime in Scotland. Who says we don't give you variety? We sure do. Listen, from Richard and myself, wish you all a really good night and catch you all soon. Thanks, everybody. Good night.